Thank you for tuning in to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. I'm Livonia Mallory.
Hi, and I'm H. Bosch Jr. We have a great program planned for you today.
Today, we're going to be discussing the funeral business with a family-owned business located in Waterford and a corporate-owned provider. The special title of this piece is The Business of Death.
We finish up with the second installment in the Hudson Mohawk Magazine Physics segment with Dr. David Borton, retired RPI professor and solar boat builder.
Afterwards, we'll hear from WOC producer Tatiana Moraney on this week's Food Fun Day, featuring Hotspot, a Jamaican restaurant in Albany. Now, the headlines. A devastating fire in Cohoes, stoked by high winds, destroyed or damaged nearly two dozen downtown buildings. The mayor reported the fire was started by a man trying to forge a blade over an illegal burning barrel in his backyard. John Gomes was apparently trying to bend metal based on the History Channel television series Forged in Fire. He started trying to do blacksmithing, and at least 20 people lost their homes.
The Times Union reports that Disability Rights now is suing the State Office for People with Disability or Developmental Disabilities in federal court over its failure to discharge 97 adults who are 21 and older from residential schools. The group claims that state's failure to make timely plans to carry out the discharges of these adults violates two federal laws. In addition to keeping the adults in inappropriate settings and depriving them of services like employment skills, training, the lack of timely discharge, block parents of younger disabled children from being placed in special residential schools, sending them out of state for placement. The group wants the state to begin planning the discharge when the individuals turn 16 years old, rather than the current system to start planning when the client turns 19.
A Chautauqua County grand jury has indicted a hunter who fatally shot a neighbor out walking her dog after sunset, but who claimed he mistook her for a deer. The hunter could face 5 to 15 years if convicted of manslaughter and hunting after hours. The hunter did not stay with the woman. The hunter did stay with the woman and called 911 after she was shot.
Rensselaer County will purchase the Italian Community Center in Troy for a senior service center. The building will replace the current location of the Troy Area Senior Service Center at 19 3rd Street in Troy, which will be sold. The Italian Center had previously been recommended as the home for Troy City Hall.
The Troy Record reported that a December 8th performance by Iranian hand drummer Mohammad Reza Matozavi at the AMP AMPAC on RPI's campus has been canceled due to the visa processing delays. On November 9th performance by Iranian dancer Ali Malini was also previously canceled due to visa processing delays. The visas were as a result of Donald Trump's restriction on travel for a number of Muslim majority countries.
The Republicans in the Senate were forced late Thursday night to temporarily slow down its mad rush to pass a massive tax cut for the wealthy after the Joint Committee on Taxation found that it would increase the national debt by more than $1 trillion. The New York Times wrote that corporate taxes, along with those on the wealthy Americans, would be slashed on the presumption that when people in penthouses get relief, the benefits flow down to basement tenements. Some measures are barely connected to the realm of taxation, such as lifting the 1954 ban on political activism by churches and conferring of new legal rights for the fetuses in the House bill. both on the wish list of the evangelical right. The bill would pressure states to limit spending on health care, education, public transportation, and social services in their longstanding battle to shrink government. Republicans have found in the tax bill a vehicle to broaden the flight beyond Washington. The result is a basmuch piece of legislation that could widen American economic inequality while diminishing the power of local communities to marshal relief for vulnerable people.
The Trump administration is seriously considering recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel in early December. According to CNN, Trump hasn't yet decided whether the announcement will specify that West Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, as opposed to the eastern part of the city, which Palestinians want to claim as their own seat of government. The administration may decide to do something to lessen the blow for Palestinians, such as an announcement that through future negotiations, East Jerusalem could become the Palestinian capital.
Michael Flynn, President Trump's former national security advisor, pled guilty today to making false statements to the FBI. He misled FBI agents during a December 2016 interview when he was asked about conversations about the U.S. sanctions on Russia with the country's ambassador to the United States. This indicates that Flynn has struck a deal with special counsel Robert Mueller's office in exchange for his cooperation in the investigation into the alleged collusion between Russia and the Trump administration. Flynn reportedly will testify that during the presidential campaign, Trump ordered him to contact the Russians.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
The economics of the funeral business project that $57 million will be generated every year by both corporate players and small family-owned businesses. The family-owned businesses are forced to compete with the corporate players as corporate players bring down pricing. The next segment is entitled The Business of Death.
This history started in the late 1800s in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
My great-great-grandfather was a carpenter and owned a livery stable. And this is a pretty common story in the funeral or mortuary world at around that time in bigger cities. You know, Kansas City would have been a bigger city, but any city of size would have had a carpenter or a livery person who, when a person passed away, they would help with transporting that person to a cemetery,
mm-hmm.
or to a church, and from a home, like you're saying, to the place of service. And what ended up happening was my great-great-grandfather was asked to make caskets for friends, customers, and as that became common practice, his way of life transformed from a carpenter and a livery stable into the word that you use, an undertaker.
So in the
late 1890s, because he was making caskets, and so that became his trade.
So Mr. Newcomer, back in that time, was a carpenter, mm-hmm. and started building caskets.
Hmm. Yeah, making wood caskets, and I guess as business would have it, that became probably more and more time consuming and more common, and he became the go-to person for that in Kansas City. And so eventually you end up with a business of building caskets for the community that you live in.
Mm-hmm.
And then you become the undertaker. And that's a pretty common story in the funeral business in America in that turn of the century time frame, where people that were woodworkers and carpenters and things like that were building caskets for their community. And that became their primary product, and then it became their way of business.
So how did you move from being a small family-owned, you're still family-owned, but a small business in Kansas to a corporation? Because you guys are a pretty big corporation, right?
Yeah, so my the business grew steadily over the generations, but my grandfather was in the business in Kansas City and was a part of the business in Kansas City, and they, as a family, through several generations, their business had grown, but he decided to leave the business for personal reasons and retained a funeral home in Topeka, which is where we are from and where we're based now. And when my dad graduated from college in the 70s, he went to work at that funeral home in Topeka, and through his own branch of business and on his own, expanded the business slowly and steadily from Topeka. And what he was doing in really the 1980s, for the most part, was purchasing small funeral homes in the Kansas area that surrounds Topeka, smaller towns, from owner-operators and bringing them under his ownership. And then what happened was, it was very common in the funeral business in the 80s and 90s, is very large companies were buying funeral homes at a rapid pace. And the price to play that game became one that was prohibitive to what he was doing, and he saw the price of funerals going up, and recognized that many families were not being treated well, were not getting the service they may want or deserve from that sort of mentality. And so he went the other way and started expanding away from Kansas into other communities, the Capital District being one, with a lower cost alternative to the high cost of funerals in general. Most people would agree that funerals can be expensive, and he just made the decision in the mid-90s to go the other direction with it and offer a quality service at a price that's usually half of what other funeral homes are charging. And so Albany was a town that was on his radar through a business partner at the time, and he was expanding to the east into Ohio and some things, and then ended up in Albany in the mid-1990s. And the community has appreciated what we've done there and just opened the second location. The original's in Colony, and the second just opened in Latham basically exactly a year ago.
So in the 80s and the 90s, did he continue the pattern of buying up smaller operators, independent operators, and then bringing them underneath his organization? Is that the vision on how you do business now? You bring in someone who is an independent operator, and they become a part of the newcomer family?
Not as much as it used to be. Very, very, very seldom. Most of our business is with a new facility that we build on our own, like we did in the Capital District with both of the funeral homes there in the area. One was this was before my involvement with the business in the 1990s. I was too young, but when Dad did that, I think it was an insurance office.
Oh, okay.
And was not operating as a funeral home, and so it was a newly established funeral home. Mm-hmm. And that's how most of them have been for the last 15 or 20 years now, of a fresh funeral home that is not already owned or operated, like you say, by an individual or family or another company, whatever it may be.
So what is it about how you guys do business that makes you special and unique?
The two things. The first is that we made the choice a long time ago to charge less than other funeral and cremation providers.
Okay.
I think if you did some research on funeral prices, you would notice that some are very high, and most people would agree that funeral and cremation services can be expensive. And we're different because we charge less. Mm-hmm. The next question is usually, well, how can you do that? And it's a pretty simple answer, pretty simple methodology. It's that we simply choose to accept less profit than other funeral providers in the area, and pass on those savings to the families that we're given the honor to serve. So that's the biggest differentiating factor. I'd say the second one is that we recognize that more and more people are asking for cremation as their form of final disposition.
Yes.
Instead of burial. And so in the going all the way back, meaning back into the 1890s time frame, cremation in the United States, at least, was basically unheard of, was totally taboo.
Mm-hmm.
And as the years went on and on, it became less so. In the 90s, the cremation rate would have been, maybe 20%. So still very, a larger amount, but a small portion of the population was choosing that. And so if you can imagine from 1900 to almost the year 2000, the percent of people choosing cremation went from 1 or 2 to 20%. And then from 2000 until now, about half of the families in this country choose for cremation when a death occurs. And we have worked very hard to embrace that trend and be experts on what's taking place when families are planning something around cremation, because families are less and less traditional in general.
Mm-hmm.
They are less and less involved with their churches.
Mm-hmm.
People are less churched overall. Families are spread out, meaning spread out over a wide geographical area. So when a death occurs, it's much more difficult for them to get together in a timely fashion to have
So it sounds like you've pretty much created a niche for yourself that, you've got a low price, a low cost option for families, which is always good.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong, is, as you said, people are less churched. And so those folks who are more church oriented or have ethnic needs or ethnic mm-hmm. traditions that they want to mm-hmm. express during the
sure.
funeral experience, it would seem to me that you would not be able to offer that sort of experience for, let's say, I don't know, maybe an Asian family, a Chinese family, or maybe an African-American family that's used to a more homegoing service kind of component to their funeral. Sounds like you wouldn't be able to offer that. You might be able to offer a cheaper version, but not that version. Would that be a fair assessment?
I don't think so. We serve an extremely diverse set of the community, and really almost any funeral service provider does in 2017. But we can accommodate any type of service, and that goes back to people being less traditional in the way they make their choices. So we have to be flexible in what we can provide and do provide, and we accommodate any type of service, whatever it may be, and certainly any sort of ethnic or cultural background or religious background that drive those decisions. Those things are still important in how people choose a funeral or cremation provider, for sure. And some people are more comfortable with people that are of a similar religion or a similar cultural background.
Mm-hmm.
But those barriers slowly break down over time, too. I think that's just the society that we live in. And so we can provide any type of service that families are desiring. And whether it's at our funeral home or at a church or at a different facility altogether. We do all those things.
Now, how have you been received by some of the more independent, culturally based, ethnically based providers, independent providers in the area? What has been your interaction or reception from that group here in the Capital District?
Since I don't personally live in the Capital District, I mm-hmm. don't know if I could answer that as well as some of our manager right there in town or some of our funeral directors. I would imagine that some competitors, while they respect us, of course they recognize that we do offer a lower cost alternative to what they may be doing. So we're another business competitor in the marketplace, but I think they respect what we do.
Now, the folks that work for you, your funeral directors, are they employed by you or are they independent contractors?
No, they're employed by us.
They're all employed by you. Okay,
yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. So tell us how one of our listeners might be able to reach out to your local companies here.
Yeah, so we have a website that we think is really user-friendly, whether people are on their computer at home or on their phone, and more people are doing it from a phone or an iPad or something like that. But newcomeralbany.com, N-E-W-C-O-M-E-R, albany.com. We also have the ability to plan a service online where a person can go through the process of learning about the decisions that are being made when a burial or a cremation service is being planned and the costs that are associated with that. If they wanted to send in that plan to us, you can do that through email, and then one of our representatives would reach back out to them. If they wanted to simply come and meet with us, then we have funeral directors and pre-planning funeral directors who can meet with people just based on an appointment anytime.
Well, thank you so much. That's John Newcomer, Operations Manager for Newcomer Funeral Homes. Well, we thank you so much for agreeing to be on the air with us today. And it's been a pleasure having you here with WOOC 105.3 FM. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So, Bosch, you know, that was the newcomer piece, the corporate player. Our next piece is going to be a local provider. Having to deal with corporate people to bury your family members, that's an interesting piece of the story.
Well, I think it was an excellent piece. You did a great job, and I feel so much smarter from the information that I learned,
You know, my mama said there's two things that are certain, taxes and death.
Amen. Mama was wise beyond her years.
But our next piece is a local provider, a family-owned provider.
Okay.
Well, end up getting into this business,
I went to college and just didn't know what I wanted to do, so I was kind of floundering. And I was working at a funeral home, which was right next door to our house, and I just knew that I liked that kind of work. And then I took some kind of an aptitude test to determine what I might be happiest at in life, and the counselor told me that being a funeral director or a farmer. I chose the funeral director part. It seemed to be less... less strenuous, but maybe not. But in any case, that's how I got started.
That's how you got started. So I'm assuming from the name that it's a family-owned business.
Yes. My wife and I started it, back in 1974.
Mm-hmm.
And we bought a house in Waterford, converted it to a funeral home, and we've subsequently added on to it to make it more formal.
Well, some people have said that the small funeral home directors are sort of like a dying breed, that they're going out of business, and that the corporate funeral providers are providing a more professional quality service, and they're meeting a need, and they're meeting it at a better price, a cheaper price than what you would get from the independent folks like yourself. What do you think about that?
I don't agree, of course. I'm going to be biased in my point of view, but you got to understand these corporate entities have funeral homes all over the country. They really can't supervise them, personally, like somebody that's running their own funeral home can. Mm-hmm. And it was present every day, 24 hours, 7 days a week. And just because they might advertise that they're less expensive, that's not necessarily the case. Certainly in some cases it might be true, but in a lot of cases it's definitely not.
So, for a standard funeral, what are some of the things that people need if they're going to, bury a family member? Like, what are some of the things you purchase for a funeral?
Well, you have to understand, we had a discussion a little earlier about a traditional funeral. Traditional funeral, of course, you would need a casket. Mm-hmm. And actually, most cemeteries would require an outside enclosure that the casket would go into at the cemetery to keep the grave from settling year after year. You need, if you're going to have a viewing, you would want to have embalming so the body is presentable. And then there's cars to be provided. Mm-hmm. Memorial cards, and also somebody to guide the funeral, guide the wake, right. To oversee it. And I say that for a traditional funeral, but you have to understand that now cremation certainly is becoming more common. You'll find that you certainly don't need a vault or outside enclosure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you don't even have to bury the ashes if you choose not to.
Mm-hmm.
But if you choose to, they can be just put in a very simple urn into the ground. Most cemeteries will go along with that. Take the ashes home with you and not inter them at all.
Right.
You could have no viewing, mm-hmm. and just have the ashes there for a reception. And there's what the people call a direct cremation. And there's nothing. I mean, there's no – we go to the hospital where the person's passed away. Bring the person back to our facility, put them in what we call a cremation container,
mm-hmm.
Do all the paperwork necessary and get all the forms and the permits, and then bring them to the crematory. And that's a direct cremation.
So you and I were talking earlier about the change and the traditional funerals, and that some people, some ethnic folks, are more traditional than others when it comes to a funeral. And you were talking about the Polish folks
yes.
tend to be a little bit more traditional.
From my experience, yes. And mm-hmm. Ukrainian people be more, you know, and they, you know, I think I was also mentioning to you that those people that are in those religions, they would always want, the body would have to go to church. I mean, it was just unwritten law. It wasn't a law, of course, but they just wanted the person to go to church.
Correct.
And then I can see over, you know, as I've been in business, see where they would just say, well, you know what, we can just have the priest or the minister come to the funeral home.
Right.
And now I've had people say, you know, we don't even need a clergyman. Maybe a celebrant or somebody just to, as an MC, to uh-huh. just facilitate mm-hmm. the service.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, yes, the Polish people, though, from my experience, would be more, they would want to still go to church. They would still want to bury in the Polish or Ukrainian cemetery.
Mm-hmm. And that's a service, I think. Maybe I'm biased. I think the smaller, more independent providers are able to provide a more personalized service to families than a big corporate entity. I mean, maybe I'm biased. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, no, yeah. I'm biased too. But I really do think if you just think about it, you've got somebody that actually owns the business there 24 hours, 7 days a week, as opposed to somebody who works a shift. And once they're done for the day, they're done for the day. And I answer my phone all night long.
All night.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I do have an answering service when I'm out, but if I'm home or at the funeral home, either place,
mm-hmm.
I answer, or my wife answers, or my son answers, because right. we're all licensed funeral directors.
Right, right.
And from our perspective, I think that we also keep the cost down because it's all in a family, if you will.
Yeah, that's good. And it's a family-owned business, and I think that's a good thing. It's a family-owned business.
And my son, who is in business now, I mean, I can remember him watching the funerals and when he was a little kid, and you know, he said to me, "I want to go down and help." You know, I said, "You can't go down and help until you're at least 12 years old, then maybe you can open and close the door for people." You know,
right.
Well, on his 12th birthday, we had a wake, and he was down there, and he's been there ever since.
Well, that speaks to, you know, your dedication and your leadership that your son wants to be a part of the business.
Yeah, and we always laughed with the little matchbox cars. He used to line them up and play funeral. He would have a funeral when he was a little kid. Now he has the real thing.
He has the real thing. So tell me a little bit about the profession. I mean, what sort of education or training do you have to be a funeral director?
Well, you know, if you go back to the early part of the 20th century, you just had to apply in New York State. Every state is different, but in New York State, New York State probably has the strictest, some of the strictest rules. You could just apply and have somebody sign that you were of good character, and you could be a funeral director mm-hmm. or an undertaker. Not an embalmer, though.
Okay.
There was an embalming school, or there is and still are, but there was the embalming schools were like a couple of weeks back then.
Okay.
And as things progressed, you could get just a license as an embalmer or just a license as an undertaker or both. Now you have to be able to embalm. And the in New York State, it's a two-year course at the junior colleges.
Okay, and, so it does require some level of training and education.
Yes. And a residency, one-year residency after the schooling.
Now, I was doing a little research on the history of undertakers, and what I read was that undertakers started as like coffin builders. They were mostly carpenters, cabin makers, and they would build coffins, and that's how they got into the undertaker business. And then in the beginning, in the 1800s, 1700s, that undertakers, the process of burying a family member was a family process. People would take care of their own family members, display them, or let's say have a wake in the parlor of their own home. And then the undertakers came in much later when undertakers started embalming bodies. And that's when the family started moving the funeral from a personal family experience over to professional undertakers. Do you know anything about the history of undertakers?
Well, yeah. What has happened is because, you know, back years and years ago, that could happen where a family could bury their own loved one on their own property.
Mm-hmm.
Now you need a licensed funeral director to go to the place where the person's passed away, you know, and to move them. You also need a licensed funeral director to bring the person either to a crematory or to a cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is all in New York State, but it's pretty much this true throughout the country. I think that, you know, years ago when they were, the wakes were in the house, the funeral director or an undertaker back then was still involved. And I've heard stories, although I've never witnessed this, I'm not quite that old, but they would put the person on ice, literally, and there would be holes in the casket, and there would be pails at the end of the casket where you could hear the drip as the ice was melting.
Uh-huh.
But during the Civil War, embalming started to become, it was a lot of the Union soldiers that were killed down south, their families wanted them back.
Right.
And so this Thomas Holmes developed arterial embalming, which was really, they used arsenic at the time, mm-hmm. which is actually a better medium than the formaldehyde that we use now, but having arsenic on every funeral home shelf in the country is not a good idea.
Right.
And so it's illegal to embalm with arsenic. But in any case, that's what we've gone to, the formaldehyde. We've gone to preserving the bodies. And then the bodies would be shipped by train back up north
mm-hmm.
so their family could view one more time because they always thought, you know, their loved one was coming home.
Right.
Alive. But, you know, at least, you know, they get to see them one more time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really how embalming started and how the practice, because in other countries, it wasn't very prevalent.
Okay. And so I knew this story about the father of embalming, Dr. Holmes.
Yeah, Thomas Holmes.
And apparently they say he embalmed Abraham Lincoln's body after he was...
I don't know if he embalmed Abraham Lincoln's body, but he embalmed Elmer Ellsworth's body. Elmer Ellsworth was a native of Malta, New York,
mm-hmm.
and he's buried today in the cemetery in Mechanicsville,
okay.
Hudson View Cemetery. And he was a personal friend of Abraham Lincoln's.
Ah.
And he spent a lot of time in the White House,
mm-hmm.
and he actually took care of Abraham Lincoln's children.
Okay.
And this was just when the Civil War was beginning, across the Potomac on a building, the Confederate flag was raised.
Uh-huh.
And he went out with a bunch of men,
okay.
went over and went up to the stairs,
mm-hmm.
tore the Confederate flag down,
mm-hmm.
and the owner of the building shot him on the way down.
Oh, no.
And they actually carried him out in the flag. And Abraham Lincoln had him waked in the White House. And then his body was brought up here to Mechanicsville.
Up to Mechanicsville. History.
Yeah, and Thomas Holmes embalmed him. Right. And anyways, Elmore Ellsworth was one of the first casualties of the Civil War.
Wow. Look at that.
I'm just fascinated by Elmer Ellsworth, just the fact that he's local and he was at such a – he first met Abraham Lincoln in Springfield, Illinois. How he happened to be out there, I'm not sure, but I think he was a clerk in his office.
Now, I have one curious thing I've always wanted to ask. Now, I was told that the wake was established because people could not be sure that a person was actually dead. And that they actually, the wake was to wait to see if the person was going to awaken. And that's where we got the term wake. Now, is that true?
Yeah. In England, that was, they had facilities where people were just brought in and there was somebody paid to sit there, you know, for a certain length of time to make sure the person was deceased. And people used to really worry about that before embalming.
Right.
Some people did anyways. And there's all kinds of contraptions that were made where there's when the person was buried, there was a string put in their hand and a pipe going up to the ground in case they were alive and they could ring this bell, you know.
whom the bell tolls,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. And obviously those things are not
We don't need that now, right?
You know, but modern science, we
but
don't
it's
need
amazing.
That.
It's yeah, really
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah. But there was, like I say, in England, there were these rooms where people were just, you know, brought and stayed there until there was probably still some decomposition occurred and they knew that they weren't.
That was it.
That was it. Yeah.
So tell us again the name of your funeral home and where it's located and a phone number that people can reach out to you if they want to.
It's the Philip J. Brendy's funeral home. We're at 133 Broad Street in Waterford. And our telephone is 518-237-8296.
And is there anything else you want to share with our listeners?
No, I really feel passionate about the funeral service that, and certainly a lot of money doesn't have to be spent, but I do think that some kind of dignity is to the deceased is very important in our society. And everybody has their own thoughts on this, and certainly whatever makes a person able to get through it, the time of grief for themselves is what they should do.
Right.
You
right.
know, and should not be, you know, led any other way than what they feel comfortable with.
Well, we thank you for over 40 years of service in the Capital District, Waterford in particular, for all that you do for the people in your community, for being a small business and a family-owned business. It's a testament to your dedication, and we thank you. And on behalf of our listeners, we're glad you came in to spend some time with us here at WOOC 105.3 FM. Thank you so much.
And thank you for having me.
That was Mr. Philip Brandes of Philip Brandes Funeral Home in Waterford. And before that, John Newcomer of Newcomer Cremations and Funeral Cremation Services. And our next segment is Food Fun Day. It's Food Fun Day at 105.3 Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Tatiana Moraney will be going to The Hot Spot, a Jamaican-American restaurant with some spicy delights. Tatiana talked with Vincent Douglas, who is the owner of Hot Spots, about his restaurant and how he creates those authentic Mexican flavors in his Albany restaurant.
Vincent, tell me what made you want to open this restaurant.
Many years of experience versus having a business of your own. That's very important to me. And how good I am with my hands and how blessed I am with my skills, that's the best thing to do.
It sounds like you're saying it just came natural to you.
Cooking from when I was a kid. Seven years old, I can remember. It's always a gift from God to me. Going to school, grandmother's cooking, all of that good stuff. It just helped me to excel, to be as good as I am. And I want to feed people, make them happy, with a smile on their face.
You know, they say practice makes perfect. Did you grow up in Jamaica?
Actually, yes, I grew up there. I spent many years, more than half of my life in Jamaica. Came here when I was 35, I'm now 52. So that's a while I'm spending in Jamaica, and I love Jamaica, but the money here is good, so, and I like to feed people, bring forth Jamaica out in America, and that's my thing.
Do your children help out in the restaurant at all?
My big daughter is here to help me. That's the only one. My middle son, which is 7 years old, he says the owner for the restaurant, and I'm the second in charge when he's not here. And but my big daughter, she's always here, been manager for the store for a few months now, and she's doing great. And I am the person in charge mostly, like cooking the food.
How old is she?
My daughter is 30. 29 to be exact, 30 this month coming up.
Oh, okay, so she's really, really big.
Big, big person.
So talk about the food. Would you say it's more traditional, or is there like a modern twist to the Jamaican cuisine you serve here?
My food is the most authentic Jamaican food you'll ever find probably in the USA, period, hands down. It's really authentic. The flavor, my seasoning, directly from Jamaica, nothing from here. I don't use Larry's seasoning, salt, or anything with those high volume sodium. I use mostly herbs from Jamaica, which are like the scallion, thyme, mixed up with different things that comes directly from Jamaica, comes to me here. So basically, you're not going to get any food as authentic as mine anywhere around.
Sounds like that definitely makes it healthier too. Do you have like a mission to have, you know, healthy food at all?
My food is more healthy, more than most of the foods around, the Jamaican food anywhere around. The food that they have around cook with a lot of oil. I don't. I use most of water to cook my food. So most of my food are water based, no butter, no oil, most of them. Basically, I use water to cook my food, so it don't make you fat and all of that good stuff. So, and I remove every fat off my, all of my meat, and I do not use oil in any of them to cook the food or any butter.
I think a lot of people would appreciate low sodium and, you know, low fat or low oil food, especially like nowadays. I think that people are much more conscious about what they're putting into their bodies.
Well, I have to eat the food myself, and each food that I cook, I have to probably, by the time I leave here, I eat enough to, you know, fill me up. So, and I am very much health conscious, so I know what's happening. A lot of people will be to obesity these days. So my thing is to make sure I can make a difference in what I'm cooking. So a lot of people don't know the value of what they're getting inside here, but I would say everybody should come right to Hot Spot, because definitely is wonderful food.
Oh, I totally agree. It's very, very delicious. I hear all the time. So tell me, what is your favorite thing on the menu?
Almost everything. What sells the fastest, I would think, is between the oxtail, the jerk chicken, curry chicken. Those are the fastest seller, with my fish, snappers, and salmon. Those are fast seller. My fish fry. I mean, basically everything sells here. But hands down to me, with the jerk chicken, the oxtail, curry chicken.
I asked you about the favorite, and then you list everything. Is it is it too much to choose from? Is it that good?
Yeah, definitely. I eat every one of them, almost every day. So which one is my favorite? I don't even know. But you'd have to come and try it for sure and know that basically every one of them is good.
What about vegetarian dishes, or I guess maybe I should say side dishes? How have you accommodated people with restrictive diets?
I have the cabbage. I do my kalaloo. We have the ackee and saltfish. I have vegetarian dishes that is coming out on our menu in a couple of weeks. We're going to use like peas and pumpkin and different things to make my own veggie dish that have no meat, period. So all of those are my personal recipe. I created them, so I'm going to be putting them on the menu in a couple of weeks' time.
That sounds yummy, too. What kind of advice would you have for people who are wanting to start their own restaurants?
For me, I would tell them don't open a restaurant. Restaurant, if you are looking to find money in the restaurant, you will never find it. It's not there. But I would tell you this, that if you have a passion and you want to waste time, I would say open a restaurant. But I would not encourage people to restaurant because you don't make money.
That's understandable. Am I correct in that you started your restaurant business in Troy?
No. I started my restaurant right here in Albany at 228 Washington Avenue. Then I leave from Troy. I leave from Albany, went to Troy, then Schenectady. I also opened my bodega. So I have been doing different ones, and I've been all over the place before with a lot of experience doing restaurant.
As someone who doesn't advise other people to open restaurants, you sure have opened up a lot of restaurants.
I have a passion, and the passion is to put my food out there everywhere for people to understand a different taste, because we have like probably about around 7 Jamaican restaurants around. I can boldly say there's none like mine.
How do you think yours is different than theirs? Outside of the low sodium and the low, you know, oil content.
Mines are blessed with God first. And the skills I have come from my head and not from anybody else. So the food that I cook here, nobody else can cook it unless I actually show them how to do it.
So you talked about all the experience you've had with, you know, owning all these different businesses. What has been the hardest part of having a business?
Get up every day and do the same thing over and over.
You think it gets old?
I think so, definitely. That's all you live for, is go home, sleep for a couple of hours, get up 5 o'clock in the morning, go to work, go back home in the evenings. For me, with my children, very important when I have them. So I spend a lot of time, as much possible time I can have with them. But I'm always in the restaurant.
Do you feel like it's worth it?
Honestly, I'm thinking about it. I don't know. I don't think it. For right now, I don't think so.
Would you ever consider selling your restaurant, or maybe having, you know, one of your children take it over?
Oh, God, yes. If somebody come and make me an offer now based on how I feel, I would definitely sell it or get out of it because of the stress that it carries. My children taking over, none of my son wants a restaurant. My daughter, I don't know what she wants. So I don't think that any of them is going to take over the restaurant. But I know for sure that I don't think I will be spending all my life or my long life left in a restaurant. So, I would hope
so. Is there something else you want to do?
I do. I do. My hands are all good. So from time to time, I do real estate. So I'll buy a house and I will fix them and rent them and whatever. So because I'm good at that too.
Is rehabbing or flipping houses like a second passion of yours?
That'd probably be a first passion rather than a second passion. It's just that I'm more confined in the restaurant, so I have to be stuck in here rather than doing the houses. But I think I enjoyed in the houses even better than the restaurant.
I can understand that. Well, thank you, Vincent.
You're most welcome.
Hotspot is located in the heart of Albany at 228 Washington Avenue. To hear previous Food Fun Day features, check out our Hudson Mohawk Magazine Facebook and podcasts.
For those of you tuning in, I'm Lavonia Mallory.
And I'm H. Bosch Jr. To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
For our next segment, at the Darrell School in New Lebanon, New York, there's a science teacher named Leah Penniman who has been working with her students on an understanding of water protection in the Capital Region. Hear her students talking about clean water in the Hudson.
Nishima, remember in the good old days when the Hudson River was oh so neat?
Yeah, drinking right from the river, fishing.
We never had to worry about floods or stinky garbage water.
I used to always go to the local fishery on Saturdays to buy my cod, and now I can only go to the frozen aisle.
The river sustained so much diverse life. I used to love exploring the shallows and marshes for interesting species.
Oh hey, you're there. This is Nishima, Sarah, and Ivan from Darrow School in New Lebanon. We were just reminiscing about how wonderful the Hudson River used to be back in the day.
Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore. But some days I sit and wish I was a kid again.
And yet this is ruining it.
Eutrophication.
Eutrophil what?
High concentrations of chemical nutrients necessary for photosynthesis, called eutrophication, result in dense aquatic vegetation that suffocates many portions of the Hudson River. These algal blooms deplete oxygen and put toxic bacteria into the water, creating aquatic dead zones where...
Hold up, wait. If you don't speak science, what she's trying to say is greedy water plants grow way out of control and kill the life around them.
Eutrophication also degrades water quality for human consumption by introducing toxic bacteria into it, leading to health issues including poisoning and cancer.
Fishing is also hindered by eutrophication, as the dense algal growth makes it difficult to see underwater fishing equipment and limits the mobility of fishing boats.
This all happens because of the everyday actions that excessively enrich the Hudson River with chemical nutrients.
Runoff resulting from the use of fertilizers containing nitrates and phosphates.
Discharge from concentrated animal feeding operations.
Sewage discharge.
Industrial waste.
And natural events such as floods that wash excess nutrients into water bodies are major causes of eutrophication.
And yes, those chemical nutrients that make all this algae grow include the same phosphates found in your laundry detergent.
So you might be thinking, how can I help to make sure the Hudson River's health is restored to how it was so long ago?
Glad you asked. There are a couple ways you can help the Hudson River out.
At the forefront of solving this issue is limiting the external load of excess nutrients we are putting into our waterways.
While industrial, municipal, and agricultural runoff must be addressed in order to reduce eutrophication, the lifestyles of many people contribute to non-point source pollution, which is the accumulation of pollutants that enter water bodies by way of precipitation and other water moving over land.
Use fertilizers responsibly by making sure you don't apply them before major rains, and you use the proper amount to avoid excess being washed away.
Or replace those disgusting chemical concentrates with things like compost and mulch that mimic natural processes and, even if they are washed into rivers, don't have nearly as drastic an effect on water health.
I know that you are used to using chemical-based products and probably have come to value them, but there are alternatives that reduce excess nutrients discharged from all of that gunk you wash down the drain.
Linked to runoff from lawns is usage of sprinklers that causes fertilizer runoff in the same way precipitation can.
Another way to help the Hudson River is by making sure your septic systems are up to date and working properly.
Make sure your building's sewage pipes remain clear of solids that can cause the pipes to break, leading to leakage into groundwater and above groundwater ways.
Now, here's a real proactive step you can take to let nature filter chemical pollutants out of affected water rather than letting it run into waterways.
As long as I don't have to do much, I say let nature do the work.
Putting various plants along the edges of lawns and other areas of land that could cause non-point source pollution is an excellent way to cleanse the ecosystem of these harmful pollutants.
These plant barriers, or wild edges, have been found to clean up to 97% of excess nutrients out of wastewater, according to one study.
Huh. Hearing all these options to help the Hudson River really gives me hope for one of our favorite rivers.
I know, and you never know. One day you could be buying your cod in a riverside fish market once again.
I think what Ivan and Sarah are trying to get at is that with your help, we could restore the Hudson's glory and protect it for many years to come.
Sailing down my dirty stream.
Brought to you by 2017 Darrow School Environmental Science students. Produced by Ivan Olizakov, Sarah Sullivan, and Nishima Vitali Peneman. Sound designed by this trio.
My Hudson River will once again run clear.
That was a group of science students from Leah Penniman's class at the Darrell School speaking about their understanding of the Hudson River ecosystem. That concludes our show. Once again, we hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Lavonia Mallory.
And I'm H. Bosch Jr. And thank you, Miss Lavonia Mallory. It's been a plum pleasing pleasure to co-host with you this evening. Remember to tune back in tomorrow every Wednesday or weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news.
To learn more about this program and how you can support the Sanctuary of Independent Media, feel free to visit our website at mediasanctuary.org.
If you like information on how you can participate in the production of this program or have any suggestions on stories you'd like to hear about, email us at info@mediasanctuary.org.
If you're interested in being a part of the radio crew here, we hold weekly meetings on Mondays and Thursdays right after the show at 7:07. You can come by the Sanctuary for Independent Media located at 3361 6th Avenue, Troy, New York.
The next episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine is featuring the list of what's on tomorrow's schedule. Until next time, thank you for tuning in.